Srimad Bhagavatam 11, Canto Chapter 17, Description of the Varnashrama System, Text 12. Treta Mukhe Mahabhaga,
Treta Mukhe Mahabhaga,
Pranan Me Hridayat
Trayi, Pranan Me Hridayat Trayi,
Vidya Pradura Bhutasya,
Vidya Pradura Bhutasya,
Aham Asam Tririnmaka,
Aham Asam Tririnmaka,
Treta Mukhe,
Treta Mukhe,
at the beginning of Treta Yuga,
at the beginning of Treta Yuga,
Mahabhaga,
Mahabhaga,
O greatly fortunate one,
O greatly fortunate one,
Prana,
Prana,
from the abode of Prana,
from the abode of Prana,
or the life air,
or the life air,
May,
my
Hridayat,
Hridayat,
from the heart,
heart.
Trayi,
Trayi,
the threefold,
threefold.
Vidya,
Vidya,
Vedic knowledge,
knowledge.
Pradurabhut, appeared. Tasya,
Tasya,
from that knowledge,
from that
knowledge.
I.
Asam,
Asam,
appeared.
Trivrit,
in three divisions.
Divisions.
Makha,
sacrifice.
O greatly fortunate one, at the beginning of Treta Yuga, Vedic knowledge appeared from my heart, which is the abode of the air of life, in three divisions, as Rig, Sama, and Yajur. Then, from that knowledge, I appeared as threefold sacrifice. Purport. In Treta Yuga, the bull of religion loses one leg, and only 75% of religious principles are manifested, represented by the three principal Vedas, Rig, Sama, and Yajur. The Lord appears in the process of threefold Vedic sacrifice. The three divisions are understood as follows. The Hota priest offers oblations into the fire and chants the Rig Veda. The Udgata priest chants the Sama Veda. And the Advaryu priest, who arranges the sacrificial ground, altar, and so forth, chants the Yajur Veda. In Treta Yuga, such sacrifice is the authorized process for spiritual perfection. The word prana in this verse refers to the universal form of the personality of Godhead. This form is further described in the following verses. Om Gana Timilandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Gena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Srivasani Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram It is not possible for us to understand the spiritual world with our imperfect and limited senses. But what about the material world? Do we have free rein for understanding the material world? Can we, with our senses and intelligence, actually get to the bottom of material existence? We can easily accept that the spiritual world is inconceivable if we're a bit humble. But the material world seems to be so obvious in its accessibility to our senses. In material existence, there's immediate reward when you apply your senses. Immediate reward in terms of the modes of material nature. This current version of human society rewards senses with the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance. That's the carrot on the stick that keeps the donkeys going. The taste of passion and the taste of ignorance. Because that taste of passion particularly is so pungent and so spicy, you suffer the illusion that you actually are participating with reality at a deep level. Passion gives you that illusion that I'm really experiencing life at its depths, because the taste of the mode of passion is so pungent and spicy and strong. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that that happiness, which seems like poison in the beginning, but is nectarian at the end, that's happiness in the mode of goodness. And, as you know, that happiness which seems to be so nice in the beginning, but ends in distress, poison, that's happiness in the mode of passion. And happiness in the mode of ignorance is just delusion from beginning to end. There's not even the promise of temporary happiness. There's just bewilderment from start to finish. As you often explained, happiness in the mode of ignorance, particularly intoxication, is an essential feature of today's civilization, in which the more bewildered and blinded and wasted you are, the more you're considered to be psychologically well-balanced. If we look at the reality that's available to our senses, we see it's very limited, if we're honest. So why do we get so proud? Why do we become so confident about material life? There's something in that taste of the mode of passion that makes one arrogant and proud. I know what I'm doing. I've got expertise. The material world has given me on-the-job training. Therefore, I'm highly experienced and qualified. In a sense, that's true. After many, many births and deaths, you have this present body. So you have experience. But the experience that you had over countless births doesn't allow you to see straight. Material experience bewilders you. It blinds you. So the more material experience you have, the less you see. And the less material experience you have, the more you see. This is the principle we've explained before, as enunciated by Shukadeva Goswami in the second canto of Bhagavatam. Pashyannapi na pashyati. You're sufficiently experienced, but still you do not see. You can't see, because just by the fact of your experience, you become blinded. So the more material experience you have, the more covered over you become, not the more expert. But in today's attempt at civilization, you're told, be experienced. The more experience you have of the varieties of material existence, the better a person you'll be, the more competent a person you'll be. So you're not supposed to simply have job experience. You're also supposed to have relationship experience. Accumulate as many different types of experiences as you can, and then gradually you'll develop into a wholesome, competent person. And what is our Krishna conscious lifestyle? Have as little material experience as possible. And then you'll be fresh and lively, and you'll be able to understand Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Yes, we seek to minimize material experience and maximize the spiritual experience. That spiritual experience can be had even on a battlefield, as Arjuna demonstrated. It's not that one has to give up the job, give up the family, and in that way reduce the material experience. No, you reduce the material experience by expertly engaging everything in material existence in Krishna's service. And then the material experience becomes a spiritual experience. That is the high mysticism of Bhakti Yoga, the transformative power of Bhakti Yoga. Material experience on its own is just for naught in terms of benefit. And in fact, it accumulates distress in that you become covered over. It's not that you become wiser. If people truly became wiser as their age progresses, then you should see an enlightened class of elderly people who are able to guide society. What happens when they get older? They become dull, very narrow-minded, very cynical. At best, their only happiness is the grandchildren. By watching the grandchildren, they feel lively. Oh, there's hope for me. I have made a major accomplishment to this world. I have grandchildren. That's about it. So where is the benefit of even the material experience in this lifetime producing an elderly person who is enlightened? You don't see that in anywhere in the world. You see political leaders, no matter how old they are, they all suffer from the same basic ignorance. You see corporate leaders, no matter how financially expert they are or competent in marketing and so forth, still, they can't give any good advice for human progress. So maybe we should just kick out the whole concept of material experience. Think about it. And maybe we should try to maximize our spiritual experience. And that is the point of Krishna's instruction in Bhagavad Gita. Maximize your spiritual experience by seeing everything as yajna, an opportunity for sacrifice for Vishnu. Yajna vai Vishnu. In the different yugas, the system of sacrifice is different according to the particular characteristics of that age. In Satya Yuga, which you've just been hearing about, the system of sacrifice was meditation on the Lord in the heart. Everyone was practicing unalloyed devotional service to the Lord from birth. Therefore, there was no need of varnashram dharma. In Treta Yuga, however, the Vedic knowledge manifests, because no longer do people have the qualification that just by vibrating Om, all Vedic knowledge comes to them. So in Treta Yuga, the Vedic knowledge appears, and also the divisions into Varna and Ashrama appear. Because people are not 100% on the spiritual platform. They need some material buttressing, some material support system, so that they can remain steady in their attempt for the spiritual platform. Varnashram Dharma is a material system. It has to do with the body and the mind. It has nothing to do with the spirit soul. Nevertheless, it's Krishna's material system. And that's why it has value. Just see how much of a realist Krishna is. Who can say that Krishna doesn't know anything about the real world, when all the worlds emanate from Krishna? Aham sarvasya prabhavo matta sarvam pravartate. Krishna is so expert in living in the real world that he even gives a material system so that we can follow it in the material world and regain our spiritual identity. This is how expert Krishna is. He knows how to organize the material world, as well as he knows how to dance with the gopis and play with the cowherd boys. He's 100% perfect and complete in expertise. Om Purnamada Purnamidam. Our situation in Kali Yuga is that no one recognizes these divisions of occupational propensity. Yet, we can see in actuality those divisions are there. No matter how much talk is made about how everyone has one vote and how everyone has equal opportunity to influence the political system, it is not like that. The shrewd prevail. This is becoming more and more known as the glaring deficiency of democracy. It's a scam. It's a trick. You've got a vote. You've got a vote. The men have a vote. The women have a vote. The young people have a vote. During Prabhupada's time with us, in his early days of preaching, particularly in the USA, He was dealing with thousands upon thousands of young people who were so angry that although at the age of 18, they could be sent to the jungles of Vietnam to die in the war, they had no vote. So now they have the vote. So what? Has anything changed? They're still going to Afghanistan and going to Iraq and paying their karmic debts there. So, political power may seem to be distributed equally through the voting system, but the shrewd always prevail. It's one of the symptoms of Kali Yuga you'll hear about in the 12th canto. Money is the predominant influence. Money. If you have money, you are known to have good qualities. Aristocracy, finesse, respectability. If you have money, then automatically you have all these things. That is the standard for Kali Yuga. The more money you have, the more justice you can get. Meanwhile, people are running around, the poor, bewildered people of Kali Yuga are running around saying, oh, I've got to vote, I've got to vote. I'm a man, I can vote. I'm a woman, I can vote. I'm a young person, I can vote. Vote, vote, vote. Makes no difference, really, in the quality of your life. It makes no difference in the blanket of ignorance that covers human society. We began by talking about our situation in material existence, our existential situation, in which, in spite of having senses that seem to take in everything around us, we're actually locked up in a very limited atmosphere or environment. Just think, if you're like an animal tethered to a wooden stake in the ground from birth to death, or in modern terms, think of a confined animal feeding operation in which cows are raised from birth in a tiny, tiny cubicle until they are led to the slaughterhouse. So their whole experience is just of a narrow box in which they're fed hormones to make them grow, to make them develop big body weight, to make them more, so they can attract a better price. So how much experience does that cow have? It's amazing. The cow doesn't even have experience of grazing in a pasture before it's dead. Have you ever seen cows lined up at a farm ready for the truck to come to take them to the slaughterhouse? I have seen it. There, the farmer has a special gate, and the cows are lined up in double row, a long double row, and the man, the farmer doesn't even have to be around. The slaughterhouse truck just drives up, and they open the gate from this narrow conduit, and the cows file up into the truck. Such a scene of gloom, because they know they're going to be killed. So, in a confined animal feeding operation, the cow doesn't even experience the pasture. Simply, the cow stays in a confined box from the time it's born until the time it's going to be led to the slaughterhouse. So we're like that in material existence. So how can we start talking about what goes on in all parts of the universe? We are bound by the modes of nature and our karma to a narrow box. And in that narrow box, we try to get all the material happinesses that we can get. And that's the story of our life. Locked up in a confined Kali Yuga feeding operation. Narrow box. But the confinement doesn't end with simply the box we're in. Our senses are also confining us. The particular senses that we have are limited in what extent of reality they can perceive. You know how animals can see and hear things that we cannot, because their senses are different. Having a different body means having different senses. Indriyani Pranyahu. The body is a bag of senses, and those senses limit what you can perceive. So you're boxed in all these ways by your mind and senses. Krishna explains in the 17th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Chividam Bhavati Shraddha Dehi Dehinam Yogi, that according to the modes of nature that rule you, you have certain kinds of mental conceptions. So you're not free in your mind. What your mind generates is a product of your contact, guna sangha, with the modes of material nature. So here your senses and your mind are prescribed by contact with the modes of nature. And then your living circumstances are confined. So in all respects, you're like a tethered creature, tethered to a wooden stake in the ground. So how much of the wider world can you know? Lord Kapiladeva, in the third canto of Bhagavatam, explains that it is a characteristic of conditioned life that whatever type of body you have, you feel quite comfortable in that body, and you feel that that body is providing you with the fulfillment you need. This is illusion. That's why it's called conditioned life. Your perception is conditioned by the type of body you have. So just see ourselves as tethered to a wooden stake. We don't know what that tether, let's say, maybe is a few meters long. So beyond that tether, how much can you know? Okay, the tether is 4 meters long, and then you, the creature, say, well, besides physically walking 4 meters, and then the rope halts me, I can see another 100 meters, and that's it. I can hear, you know, sounds from long distance, or I have scientific instruments that will extend my sense perception. Still, you're a tethered creature. The scientific instruments that you make are the product of your limited senses. Yet, we want to make pronouncements about even the material world. More and more is becoming obvious. These pronouncements are not working. People are not economically and politically satisfied. It's impossible to satisfy anyone economically and politically. They're not just economic units of production and consumption. They're not just political votes. They are spirit soul, and the spirit soul has spiritual needs to be in connection with Krishna. So that is our preaching program. That's our outreach and cultivation program. We recognize you have needs that can't be fulfilled economically or politically. Now you may say, oh, but you're just hypothesizing that there's a spiritual necessity because there's some emptiness in you. Therefore, you've dreamed up that there's a Krishna and that there's bhakti and that there's relationships with Krishna because you're hungry for relationships. Therefore, you have dreamed all these things up. Well, then I could say you have dreamed up that there is water just because you're thirsty. Will you stop drinking water? No. It's just a dream. You see, you have this need for water, and because of that need for water, you've conjured up that there is such a thing as water. You see, you understand, right? So therefore, in the same way, you have this need for a God, especially a personal God. And because of that need for a personal God, you've actually hypothesized one. You've constructed a mythology in order to fulfill yourself. The Krishna consciousness process is actually dealing with genuine spiritual needs. We recognize those needs. That is the core of our outreach work. We don't shy away from those needs. We see them in ourselves and we see them in others. We want to bring it out into the open. Let's bring it out. You've got spiritual needs. I've got spiritual needs. Now, how are we going to fulfill them? Often people are embarrassed to acknowledge they have spiritual needs in a specific way. Because it seems like that's admitting failure. To acknowledge I have spiritual needs means that what? I couldn't successfully satisfy myself materially, and now I'm taking to spiritual life because as a last resort. We need to help people to become comfortable with their having spiritual needs. Recognize those spiritual needs and then connect them to the actual fulfillment of those spiritual needs. The spirit soul requires connection with the supreme soul. That is the yoga system, the supreme science of connection. Recognize you have spiritual needs and then make the right connection to fulfill those needs. So all these processes for the different yugas you read about, they're different processes of yajna, sacrifice. In Satya Yuga, the yajna is meditation. In Treta Yuga, the yajna is ritualistic sacrifice. And in Dwarpa Yuga, as you know, the yajna, the sacrifice, is opulent temple worship. And in Kali Yuga, the yajna is Sankirtan yajna, the congregational chanting of the holy names of the Lord. The more we understand our life as a vehicle for sacrifice, for yajna, the more things become clear. If we view our life as an opportunity to make our mark in the world, I'm going to enjoy, I'm going to control, I'm going to be expert and get fame and acclaim, the less we'll understand the power of yajna. Krishna wants to help us to understand yajna. That's why in Bhagavad Gita he says, if you want to know the truth about all the different forms of yajna that I've already explained in the fourth chapter of the Gita, then I advise you to take advantage of my system. Krishna's system is personal. Krishna says, you approach the guru and understand what is yajna and how to apply yajna in your life. Krishna is a person. A person gives a personal system. And if you're interested in connecting with that person, you take the person's system. So Krishna has said, the bhakti system requires guidance. Evam parampara praptam, amam raja seyogaju. I gave this parampara system. And in that parampara system, the saintly kings, the saintly leaders of society, the organizers of society, they're getting this knowledge because especially the government leaders need to understand how to satisfy the people. Satisfaction comes by reducing the material lust and increasing the spiritual desire. Then Krishna tells Arjuna, I'm explaining this to you, this knowledge of yajna, how to live as a perfect human being. I'm explaining this to you because you're my devotee and my friend. Therefore, you're going to be able to comprehend. So the more we understand that bhakti has guidance embedded in it, the more we can actually apply Krishna's instructions successfully. Krishna has planned it that way. Bhakti without guidance doesn't exist. It's an hallucination. Because the very definition of bhakti is that you're doing things Krishna's way. How can you do bhakti not Krishna's way? That's not bhakti. So Krishna says quite straightforwardly that bhakti includes guidance as an essential part. And then you can understand all the yajnas that he's explained in the fourth chapter of the Gita. And the proof that you understand the yajnas having had proper guidance, is that you won't be an illusion anymore. Yajgatva na puna moham. Krishna says, you won't be an illusion anymore. You'll see all living beings, they're in me, in their mind. You'll have the proper vision. You won't have the material vision of a tethered animal anymore. You'll finally be able to see reality for what it is. The clouds will lift, and you'll see all living beings as Krishna's parts, and you'll be able to deal with those parts in a way that enhances their Krishna consciousness. Therefore, in the sixth chapter of the Gita, Krishna says that the perfect yogi never loses sight of Krishna, and Krishna never loses sight of the perfect yogi. Their relationship is that tight. And that relationship becomes established and nurtured by the system of sacrifice. And the sacrifice requires guidance. This is Krishna's way of doing things. The system of yajna can be difficult to understand. How to apply bhakti in life. Krishna understands that it's not always easy. Arjuna is showing how it's possible to become bewildered about applying bhakti. His whole conundrum, his whole difficulty with the battle of Kurukshetra was, what am I doing here? Why are we fighting? And what does this have to do with anyone's welfare? So Krishna explained that this battle is going to go on with you in it because I want it. It's a personal thing. I don't like Duryodhana and company. I want them out. They may be topmost administrators. They may be competent. They may be vying to care for the people as genuine Kshatriyas. But they just got one problem. They don't like me. I want them out of here. Now you may say, well, isn't Krishna being sectarian? Yes, Krishna is sectarian in that what he wants, he gets. He's the only one who's allowed to be sectarian because he reigns supreme and everything is his energy. So if you want to talk about being sectarian, like being partial to this one and not partial to that one and having a particular view, yes, Krishna does have a particular view. Now the whole point of Bhagavad Gita is to get you to understand Krishna is entitled to have his particular point of view. And the more we do not accept Krishna's point of view, the more we suffer. Of course, then we take shelter of impersonalism. Okay, Krishna, you can have your point of view, I have my point of view, everyone has their point of view, it's all, you know, yatra mat tatra bhavet. All the paths are leading to the same goal. Your opinion leads to the same goal. My opinion leads to the same goal as your opinion, Krishna. We're all in it together. You have very nicely spoken Bhagavad Gita. I have prepared a very nice financial report in my business. What's the difference? Krishna, you're on the battlefield on the chariot with Arjuna. I'm at my desk in the bank. What's the difference? You give the Bhagavad Gita opinion, I give the financial projection opinion, same thing. This is our illusion. But once you accept, actually, that Krishna has a right to his opinion, in Bhagavad Gita he even says, that is my opinion. Now you may say, well, just see, Krishna himself is admitting he's got an opinion. Meaning, you can disregard it because it's his own personal thing. But then you have to understand the nature of the personality of Godhead and why Krishna's opinion is not ordinary. He asks for Arjuna's participation in the battle of Kurukshetra because he has an opinion, he has a desire. I don't like the guys who are in power right now. I want them out of office. No good can come about with them in the office. And Arjuna's pleading, look, if they really want the kingdom, let them have it. There'll be so much problem from bloodshed and destruction of families. I'm not attached. Let them have it. Isn't that the peaceful way to go about this? And Krishna's out of it. I have my wants. You can only be an instrument. Anyway, even if you don't participate in this battle, I'm going to get my way anyway. They're all dead. Now you can be a part of it and get the credit, or I'll still get my way. Now what are you going to do about that? Just like if we do not perform sacrifice for Krishna, Yajna Vai Vishnu, we'll have to sacrifice anyway. We'll toil in the material world. We'll toil, even if we're very wealthy, we'll still toil and labor and struggle hard with our mind. The only relief will be intoxication. So one way or another, your energies are sacrificed. So you get to choose which altar you're going to sacrifice at. The altar of material illusion or the altar of Krishna's pleasure directly. Sanity begins by our understanding how we're not able to understand this world completely by our ordinary senses and intelligence. We're bound up, tethered to a wooden stake in the ground. We've got some leeway, maybe 3 or 4 meters. That's it. That's the extent of our world. And our senses don't take us much further. And the senses themselves are part of the conditioning. So where does this pride and arrogance come from that I've got everything worked out enough to have a satisfying life? It's a complete hallucination. People need our help to point out why they are weary, why they are frustrated. They can't even recognize why. Why their hopes are crumbling. Why they can't be satisfied with the best economic and political arrangements they can dream up. They need help to recognize what is really the problem. They know there's a problem, but they can't get their fingers on it. What actually is it? So therefore, we are presenting the reality of their having spiritual needs and the processes by which to satisfy their spiritual needs. And in this way, the highest service to society is done.